There's a saying from Australia that I don't know if you'd be familiar with. It goes something like, so I think it's from Australia. When you're up to your butt in alligators. You know alligators?
No.
Crocodile? Alligator? When you're up to your butt in alligators, it's hard to remember that your intention was to drain the swamp. When we come on a retreat, we perhaps come with a deep aspiration for freedom, for peace, for discovery of what is possible. And sometimes it can seem that amidst the challenges and the struggles and the various difficulties we encounter, we lose sight of that deeper aspiration, that larger or vaster vision that we might have in our hearts and our lives. And so it's always useful just to come back and remember the preciousness and the importance of the opportunity that we have and what we're engaging in here together. Sometimes in the sort of middle portion of a retreat, when we've gone through the challenges of arriving, settling, engaging with the practice, adjusting to the schedule, there can be a way in which it starts to feel almost surprisingly like it's actually not too bad here. You know, things are okay. Actually feels occasionally even relatively comfortable, and there's a way in which it can easily become, oh, okay, it's time to feel comfortable, great, this is what I'm up for, just let's get a bit more comfortable and then I'll just relax for the rest of the way. It's going to be a nice cruise on here. Food's good, temperature is pleasant. And it's quite understandable, of course, but just coming back again, and we look, like coming back to the breath, we need to come back again and again to what it is that brings us here to this retreat, what it is that brings us or moves us to come into our lives more fully, more wholeheartedly, with more courage and willingness to see and to explore this life. Because it's not surprising, in a way, I guess, that meditation can easily become a reenactment of our life patterns. I find myself saying this often. Anything that happens in meditation happens in your life. Really, the only difference is that here you've got a better chance of seeing that it's happening. So all the things we do in our lives, we do here. And we do them in relationship to the meditation practice. So, very easily, as one example of that, we start using the practice as a way of trying to get comfortable, as a way of trying to somehow create a sense of a container or a situation which we feel safe, in which we feel unthreatened, in which we can kind of just relax. And if we could get there, it might be that what we get to do, and this is one of the nice things about being comfortable and safe, it's very attractive, is when it's comfortable, when it's safe, actually, we can go to sleep. We don't need to be awake. And it's not been an unusual occurrence that someone on a retreat will come and report that they were working and struggling with some difficult physical discomfort, and it was really problematic, and it seemed if only this would go away, then my retreat would go easily and I would be able to meditate. And when the pain disappeared at some point, as pain often can and does, they found themselves falling asleep. And there's a relationship here between being awake and our willingness to engage with the challenging aspects of life. To not use practice as a way of more skillfully or more apparently spiritually encasing ourselves in a protective shield. Because what it means to be human, this condition of our existence, is one in which it is profoundly, or it is, we are profoundly driven, it seems, to find safety, to find security, to somehow prevent ourselves being impacted by life. There seems to be a very strong drive for most of us. And this arises because if there's an underlying vibration in many people's lives and many people's hearts of fear, of a sense of danger, of a sense of threat, that has obvious and appropriate biological roots. We have to learn not to get eaten and to find enough to eat so we survive. And yet that particular way in which we're wired up can tend to drive our life in a way that, when we're well beyond actually the issue of whether we're going to survive, we're nonetheless living our life as if we were on the edge of that issue. In a certain way, that creates a life experience where it's dominated by fear. Life is vulnerable. There's an incredible vulnerability in life. And as a response to that, often, habitually, we move into fear and reactivity, and we've spoken about these. Another possibility to this, as a way of responding to this condition, is something we've also spoken about in different ways in which Leela was guiding with regard to the loving kindness practice, that the fact that we all, and not just us, but all creatures fear pain and wish for safety from harm. We can respond to that reality with a sense of just trying to avoid it, or by aligning our hearts with a sense of that well-wishing. And so the loving kindness is a wholesome and a beneficial and a powerful way of responding to the fact that we are subject to that which is painful and difficult. Dukkha, as Leela was speaking about last night. And yet there's more to it than this, than just the sense of the painful or the difficult. This whole very sense of seeking for security, seeking for a sense of safety, is something that we really need to examine. So that, is that okay, volume-wise? I noticed myself leaning forward to get down to the mic, so it's not so useful. So much of our experience and the way we act when we're habitual, when we're unconscious, is geared around this basic principle that I need to somehow control my experience in order to protect myself, in order to produce the experiences I wish. And we've talked about this, we've reflected on this, we've seen how much we do this in our meditation, in our lives. And it's important to reflect on why this is going on. In one way, it's simple. Yes, we don't like pain, of course. And so, obvious. And at another level, do we really take on the depth to which that penetrates our experience? One of the things that for a number of people was arising today was noticing how strong the mind was, how powerfully it pulls, and how repetitively and compulsively it draws us in to cycles and patterns of thinking, even when the thinking processes itself are painful or uncomfortable to us. The very fact of the mental activity creates a sense of something that we can feel some security within, even if it's profoundly uncomfortable or painful to us. Somehow it creates a sense of some security because we're busy doing something about the condition. We're involved in an activity that we believe or imagine is directed towards our safety, our protection, our preservation, or the advancement of our well-being in some way or form. And often what's going on, and I invite you, if you experience this at times, to check in and see, often what's going on is that in our bodily experience, at the same time as the mind is very busy, something else is happening that we're not fully aware of, or that we're not open to. And so often if we notice, oh wow, the mind's really busy, it's really sticky, it's really going for it on something, or it keeps coming back to something. When you notice that, if you just ask yourself, well, what's happening in my body right now? And it may be, and for many they will find, that there's some place of contraction, or some place of pain, or some place of tightness or numbness that in some way we're reacting to, and that's related to the patterns of thought. And so it can be really useful in that to come back into the body and notice and see, can I be with this experience? So much of the thought is, whether obviously and directly or less so, Sometimes it's several steps removed. But it's somehow trying to resolve. It's somehow trying to resolve the experience we're having. Imagining that it's about the thing we're thinking about, which might be in the past or in the future, when in fact it's in relationship to something that's happening right here in our body. And if we can contact, if we can connect with, if we can be with that experience, begin to open to it, rather than trying to escape from it or avoid it or somehow shut it down by contracting within, as we often unconsciously do, if we can be with that experience, we don't need to resolve the scenarios, the scenarios or situations from the past or the future that we imagine it's connected with. Because there will always be more scenarios. There is no resolution in that process. And we see how painful it is to be caught in it. So this process of being caught in and drawn and driven in this way, if we reflect on it, what's underlying here that we're maybe not really taking on board as how things are? In Dharma practice, we're interested in understanding the way things are. And as we understand that and come into alignment with it, suffering reduces and ultimately dissolves. Freedom increases and deepens. This is the effect or the nature and the process of what happens as we see the way things are and start to live in accordance with them. And so we look to see, what is it about this human condition? You know, we are remarkably sensitive. Sometimes people feel like I'm, you know, like not me, but yeah, and I, but each ourselves think, I feel really sensitive. And other people don't necessarily seem to be so. But in fact, we're all remarkable. Others know very well how sensitive they are. It sort of depends on the stories we tell ourselves. But as human beings, we're incredibly sensitive. Our bodies can only survive. You think in centigrade here or Fahrenheit? Centigrade, I hope. Because I can't think in Fahrenheit. Good. Okay. So, you know, temperatures in centigrade range from about -273 to umpteen thousand million. And human beings, just on the bit inside here, need to stay between, 36 and 38. You get below 36, above 38, it's really unpleasant. 2 degrees more, either direction, and done. Actually, you can get a little more than 40, probably, but not much. Yeah? And you think, wow, this system. And you think of the size of the scale, from -273 to +200 million, 500 million, whatever it is at the core of the sun. And you think, wow. Really lucky that it's just this temperature here, huh? Because for something that's this sensitive, the odds of it surviving almost anywhere else are really, really small. So there's a sort of bit of good fortune in this. But it's also like, oh wow, yeah, we are only comfortable. And you see how, we have to work, how much effort we put into staying comfortable here. Here it's mostly dealing with the heat. In other countries it's more dealing with the cold. But it's still trying to keep within that relatively narrow, tiny, tiny, tiny little comfort zone. We hear a sound. Sounds can be really, really loud. But we can kind of be comfortable with only relatively quiet sounds. Kind of sounds that can be made that are just beyond what we can tolerate. And of course, there's just examples. There's many things we could point to. How just our physical system is set up, it's incredibly sensitive. Incredibly sensitive. And emotionally, of course, too. Yeah? We notice just how a look from somebody of kindness can... And a moment of feeling ignored by another, and we can... it's that true, isn't it? Even around here, and here we really notice how we might be just looking just for one smiling face. And just one, and we're happy. They didn't even smile at us, they were just smiling. But there's a story about a samurai warrior in medieval Japan who was walking along the road, contemplating deep questions of spiritual practice and understanding, deep thought, and he came across an elderly Zen monk sitting on the side of the road in meditation. And he looked and he thought, maybe I'll ask this monk, maybe he knows something. So he says, "Monk, can you tell me the difference between heaven and hell?" And the little monk looks up at him. He's kind of old and kind of wrinkly. And he says, "Samurai, your robes are dirty and tattered. You haven't washed for a while and smell bad. You are a disgrace to your noble order. Why should I talk to you?" And the samurai, proud warrior, pulls out a sword, and this pipsqueak, insolent, insulting little man, "I'm going to take his head off." And just as he was there, ready to strike, the Zen monk sitting there looks up and says, "That's hell." And in the moment, the samurai realizes, "Oh my gosh, this man said a few words to me and I was about to kill him." And he has this, and he was seeing, totally in the control of rage and his sense of his personal ego being affronted by this little, you know, pipsqueak. And he realized, "I was going to take his life." And he's risked his life, really. He has risked his life to give me this lesson, this teaching. And he's suddenly filled with love and appreciation and gratitude. He puts his sword down and he beams at this little monk with joy and happiness and love and gratitude. And the monk sitting there says, "That's heaven." And you know, we recognize ourselves there. So much suffering from something so little, and so much joy or happiness too from something like this. And this world impacts upon us, it impinges upon us, it touches us. And if we don't really take that on and say, "This is how it is, and it's no other way it can be," what we find ourselves doing is trying to somehow get out of that condition. And we keep busy, we keep doing, we're always engaged in activity. And we don't see that the activity itself is deeply painful to us. More painful than the vulnerability or the impact upon it. I had a really interesting experience of this once. I was teaching a retreat in France on the side of a hill. We were camping up on the hill, it was a very beautiful place. And there were lots of flies, as well as a beautiful place, there were flies. And at one point I was sitting there and this fly came and it landed on me. I don't mind flies too much, but this one bit. I was like, just, you know, brushed it off me. I thought, it'll go away, but no, every time I just brush it off, and I'm starting to... And I was like, this was going on for one, so I think, and I really am committed in my practice to the precepts, in the sense of, I don't want to kill this thing, but I can feel myself now. You know, this fantasy of, you know, next time it lands, I'm going to go poof, you know, rather than just brushing it off. And I was like building this real sense of this killer rage, because it was, and I was this tension and this sense of contraction in my body. It was like, and then I realized what was happening. This moment of mindfulness came, and it's like, wow, you're scared, you're afraid, you're terrified, you're angry, you're going to kill something. And I thought, okay, let it bite. Now let's see what happens. And it's still going, and it goes, and bites. It's like this, okay. Actually, it had already done that every time I brushed it away. I only wanted to do it once. Okay, a minute or two later, it's happy, it goes, it's gone. Wow. And you know, it was so clear to me how much it was suffering and painful to me in my fear, in my anger, in my contraction, and how this little small change, nothing really at all to be worried about. And we do this so many times. I was not being hurt by the fly. I was being hurt by my own unwillingness to be vulnerable to the fly. So there's this urge, there's this movement to seek for security, to seek to be protected, to be safe. And in meditation, we need to be really aware of it. Once, some years ago, at a retreat centre in England where I'm closely involved in the running and teaching there regularly, called Gaia House, one of the teachers, Christina Feldman, who used to come to Israel years ago, I don't think she has for many years, anyway, she'd been teaching for about 20 years at this point. She ran into the staff dining room, which was also the office and the main sort of living space for the managers and cooks of the retreat. She came in, the guys, and she said, I've had an insight. I was like, oh, Christina. She doesn't actually get, if you know Christina, she does not get excited very easily about anything. She's very cool, very... And I had an insight. I'm thinking, Christina, you've been practicing for how many decades, teaching for how many decades? You must have had an insight before, you know? I was like, I had an insight. And she says, the only way that ego can survive meditation is to turn it into an object. And what that means, or what she meant by that, when we talked about it, the only way the ego can survive meditation is to make the meditation into something that it is doing. And the moment that happens, it's just another form of whatever else goes on in the world. It just looks a bit more spiritually cool. And as soon as that starts to happen, what we also notice is there's a building of a subtle sense of pressure and a need to find things that we can measure to tell us whether or not we're succeeding in doing it. The feature of doing, anything we do, requires something we can measure in order that we can compare to see that there's more of it than before we did something, or else obviously we haven't had any effect. So is there more concentration? Is there more insight? Is there more loving kindness? We start getting into measuring and comparing, and it becomes a quantitative exercise. This is materialism. Materialism, consumerism, is quantitative. Life, in terms of what we're interested in, what I think we're interested in, what I'm interested in, I think you're interested in, is qualitative. It's not to do with quantities. It's to do with what touches us. And when that sense of looking for something we can measure and quantify starts to happen, there's a heaviness that starts to arise in the condition of the activity. There's a certain weightiness, not the weightiness of commitment or of debt, but the weightiness of sort of a sense of pressure. Because we're, at the same time we're hoping to succeed, we're also terrified of failing. And again, not unusual in conversation to find when someone is saying the meditation is really difficult, you say, okay, what's difficult? Oh, it's the knees, or I can't stay with my breath. Okay, but what's difficult about that? Well, you know, and it can be all these different things. Well, it's like, I can't do it. It's like somehow there's this sense of me that's failing here. And I might have said this already, but meditation is designed for you so that you cannot help but fail at it, in those terms. So, you know, if you are, hey, you're doing well. What we have to do is see that process and begin to let it go. Because the search for security, the search for certainty, the attempt to escape from the inherent vulnerability of life is something that can't be resolved in that way. If you want certainty, it's available. But it's this, and this is the only certainty available in life. It ends. Nothing else is certain. Absolutely nothing else is certain except that. Life, at some point, for all of us and for everything, ends. And we don't know when. There's this reflection in the Dharma teachings that the Buddha invited his followers and practitioners to come to again and again. only death is certain, and the time of death is uncertain. In this situation, what should I do? It's like a question. In this situation where death is certain, but the time of it is uncertain, what should I do? What makes sense here? It's really the basis for deeply looking at, investigating, exploring our lives as we are here, as we're doing here. And yet to see that with it comes this very interesting dilemma. We've got this deep pull or call within us, it seems, to find security, to find certainty, to know things. You know, sometimes we're happy to have bad news. At least we know what it is. You know, we're happier to at least know the bad. And often we imagine the worst, thinking at least if that happens, I'll know what's going to happen. Even though it doesn't happen, often, you know. It's like this perverse kind of security. Was it Mark Twain once said, almost all of the worst experiences of my life never actually happened. But the imagining that it's going to happen becomes such a painful experience, and yet despite how painful it is, we somehow feel safe because at least we know, and there's a certainty there. It's like somehow we choose the certainty, even though it's painful. But it's an illusion of certainty. It's not certain at all. And there's this incredible dilemma. We seek certainty to try and make us feel comfortable about the insecurity of life, the vulnerability of life. And yet the only certainty that's really available, the only certainty that's real, i.e. that we're going to die, does not make us feel better about vulnerability. It does not resolve it at all. In fact, it throws us directly onto it and into it. So there is no escape from this vulnerability. There is no way we can avoid it. And fortunately, of course, avoiding it is not what we're asked to do here. We're asked to enter into it. To enter into it wholeheartedly and as consciously and courageously and kindly as we can. To really let ourselves feel and know that this is how it is. Not just for ourselves, but for all of life. And for me. And you. Helen Keller, who lived a remarkable life, even though deaf and blind, she once wrote of this situation. She said, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, and nor do the children of man experience it as a whole. Nor do the children of woman experience it as a whole. The avoidance of danger is in the long run no safer than outright exposure. Life is either a glorious adventure or it is nothing." Remarkable words from a woman who I think really lived what she had to say. And so here, what does that mean for us? To not avoid this vulnerability. We are asked to look at what is the experience, what's the perception, what's the belief that's going on in this experience of vulnerability that makes it so scary or so challenging to us. I mean, it's clear in one way we could say that we fear death, and we want to avoid it, but we can't. That simply. So much of what goes on in us, not just biologically but psychologically, is that we want to avoid death and we can't. It's not possible. There's this conflict between the urge to stay alive and the, you know, biologically driven thing to maintain the species and all of that, and the hard and harsh it seems, reality that it's not possible. And of course we might say, oh no, I'm not afraid of death, you know, it's okay, it's fine, you know, I don't mind, it's just going to be something, in which case it's okay, or it's going to be nothing, and that sounds alright. After death. But it's more like, for most of us, what Woody Allen said, I think, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. It's like the Buddha, and even Leela spoke of this, like birth, aging, sickness, death. I used to think, why is it in that order? Because always there is sickness before there is aging. I got sick long before I knew I was aging. But actually, the period before death, there's a kind of aging. Sorry, there's an aging and then sickness. The sickness before death, where the body starts to decay, stops functioning, and we're still here. I think that's what he meant. And that's why it comes in that order. Birth, aging, sickness, death. Because it's hard. It's hard. My grandmother, who was 94, died last year. She's Israeli. And she spent her last 2-3 years in her mind, lost from this world, in the stories of the Holocaust and her survival in that time, and thinking her daughter, my aunt, was her jailer, which was pretty hard for my aunt. Thinking, you know, and so psychologically, incredibly painful that the mind is broken down. She's taken back to this most incredibly difficult time. And her body starts to break down too. The skin starts to break down, so it doesn't hold together anymore. It's just, you know, bleeding, sores. I spoke of bed sores 3 or 4 days ago. She had not just bed sores, but body sores. The skin wasn't holding anymore. Life was still beating in her heart. Still plenty of fire, but whoa. And you think, I know what Woody Allen meant in that. It's like, that's quite something to have to face. And of course, it may not be sad for us. We can also be, as it was a different story of a grandmother. But you know, lovely, why not? You know, the soap opera. And yet, it's like, wow. There are different possibilities for how it happens. And in this, what is it that we're really concerned about? I mean, obviously there's the impact of the uncomfortable, the painful, the difficult. One of the reasons it's useful here to practice being with the uncomfortable, even though we can adjust our positions anytime we like, is that there will come for all of us, and most of us already, things that are uncomfortable that we cannot adjust out of. We're stuck with them. And either we fight them and scream for the rest of our life with them, or we learn to find peace with them. So here we do that when we can change once we hit our limits. It's a great way to learn. That's some of the wisdom of working with the reality of our bodies. But coming back to what is really the deeper struggle, the deeper fear, and you know, when we think of what it might be to lose our mind to the degree that we're left in the place of our life, which was in a life of 94 years, 5 or 6, for my grandmother, but a time of great difficulty, and that's, it seems tragically, where she lived out a large part of her last time. There were also good times and beautiful, sweet contact, and it wasn't easy. So what is it that feels threatened when we contemplate our mind coming up? Which happens in that process, either before or during or as the body comes apart, as it must, it's its nature. It's the sense of me, it's the sense of who I am that is under threat here. And that sense of who I am is, for most of us and much of life, completely unexamined, unquestioned. It's sort of like it's just a given. Like, you know, the sun goes around the planet, water goes downhill, and just, I'm here. So what is this, if we start to become interested in it? Because it's clearly, this is the place at the core of the contraction of the fear and the need for protection and security and safety. This is at the core of that. And what is it that's happening? few years ago I was teaching a retreat at Guy House, the place I mentioned just now, and the staff there had just come up with a new initiative for, they're always trying to find ways to be more ecologically sensitive and conserve resources and things like that. And one of the staff had noticed that the toilet rolls, the cardboard cylinders in the middle of the toilet paper, were being sometimes thrown away. Oh, we can recycle those. And good recycling for cardboard in this area, so that's good. So someone went round in each toilet, put one cardboard roll that said, "Please save me." Let's put it there. And so the idea was other people would just put them beside it, and then they could be taken away once a week and recycled. And when I came into the house, and this had happened, and I went into the bathroom, and I saw it, I thought, I understood what was happening, but the thought occurred to me, what if somebody didn't understand what was happening? And they'd say, "Please save me." It's like, someone's in danger. Someone needs help. And then they might think, oh, there's that tower above the meditation hall. It's an old sort of chapel. And it's got a trapdoor and it's locked. And it's like, maybe there's someone up there and they've left a note. But it was too dangerous to come out. So, you know, and then you see somewhere else, there's another one, a variation, says, "We can be saved." And it's like, there's more than one. There's a whole lot of people somewhere in danger. And I just had this, it was in a way quite funny, and another way quite touching and tragic, just to imagine if one didn't understand what it meant when that message came out. And imagine this retreat and walking around the house feeling really concerned. No wonder we're not allowed to talk, you know, the secret again. And it's funny, isn't it? Because we think it's rather obvious what's going on and how silly it would be to think there was someone locked away because the loo roll said, "Please save me." And yet when a thought runs through my mind saying, "Help, I'm in danger, save me," we do exactly the same thing. The toilet roll's message was not just "save me," but "Pay attention to what you're doing with this little thing here. Don't just throw it away carelessly. We can take care of it in a way that's respectful and appropriate." So when something comes to us that there's fear and tells us you're in danger, it may be true that there's some danger. We need to maybe take care of something sometime. Standing on the road, car coming towards us, we could just say, "Oh, just fear, no problem." And I said, "It doesn't matter." No, that's stupid. It wouldn't make sense, would it? We wouldn't do that. It's called intelligence, actually. To know to get out of the way of something coming towards us. Not fear. Though we might feel afraid, it's intelligence that says step out. But if you've ever been hit or nearly hit by a car and a car comes close to you, even when you're not on the road, you'll go, "Ah!" And I was once knocked over by a motorcycle. I still have a scar on my elbow. Any time a motorcycle comes down the road, even if I'm not on the road, my whole body goes, "Jump, run, go." But I'm safe. I'm completely safe. Because I'm not on the road. But something in me. So, in that moment, I need to pay attention. Just check, am I on the road? Am I on the road? If I'm on the road, get off the road. You don't want to get hit by a motorcycle or a car. But if I'm not on the road, it's like, feel the sensation. Whoa! Some people pay for this kind of experience. Really, they do. You go to a fair, you can pay lots of money to get this experience. So just feel it. There's no danger. Yeah. But the signal said, "Save me." So we're asked to look at and to examine the sense of me that feels in danger here. Of course we need to take care of our bodies, our hearts. We need to be respectful and sensitive in how we act and what we expose ourselves to. Of course, and that, you know, the practice of loving kindness is a really beautiful way that we've introduced and that we use in this practice to care for our hearts in their sensitivity and their vulnerability and their tenderness. And yet, also there is this practice of wisdom that takes care of our hearts and takes care of this vulnerability. Not just by caring about it, by understanding what is at the heart and the root of it. And the sense of our existence, if we examine it, what is it that's here that's happening? The sense of me arises really around two primary bases. And the first is that we seem to be aware of this life going on. There's sounds and smells and tastes and thoughts and feelings and body sensations. And there's one other sense, but I seem to have forgotten them. But there's six of them, including the mind. Smell. Thank you. And the sense comes with it that I'm smelling, I'm hearing, I'm tasting, I'm touching, I'm feeling, I'm thinking. That's the sense that comes with it. And yet, if we stop and say, well, what's that? Oh, that's a thought that says I'm thinking. Well, it's a thought that says I'm feeling. It's another thought. And it's a feeling that feels like it's me that's feeling. It's a feeling. Oh, it's still a feeling. So there's thoughts and feelings, but they're about me. How can they be me? How can I be having them? Aren't they just happening? I mean, isn't one of the things that we see here again and again, sometimes it's a relief, sometimes it's embarrassing, but it just keeps on happening, this thing called being alive. At least until it stops. But until it stops, it just keeps on happening. And if we try and say this is me, or this is who I am, then we're forced to confront the fact that what I am keeps changing, keeps flowing from one expression or form or circumstance into another. And in one situation we turn up looking like this. People are nice to me, I'm a cheerful, happy, friendly person. People are unfriendly to me, I can be irritable or jealous or annoyed or angry or whatever. We say, well, according to what comes, I turn up different. So what's going on here? It looks like an interactive process. There's not something over here that's somehow doing what it does separate from everything else that's going on around it. If we look, we'll see this is what's happening. The sense of me is one of the things that's happening. We're not saying it doesn't happen, but it gives the idea that there's more to that sense of me than in fact there is. It's an experience that we have. And together with that sense of me that arises on the fact that there's this experience of conscious life, knowing and being touched by thoughts and sounds and feelings and tastes and touch, and it's mostly happening so quickly that we can't see what's going on. Which is why here we sort of slow it down and simplify it, so we start to notice a bit more clearly. There's also the sense of, I'm somehow making it happen. You notice that? Like, it's happening this way because of me. And if it's all gone horribly wrong, it's my fault. And if it's going really well, then hey, it's my credit, I'm succeeding. It's really attractive and seductive, that perception. Even though sometimes it's, again, a very painful in the sense of, it's my fault. So often when we encounter pain and suffering, the real, one of the most deep and most powerfully painful elements of that is the way we take it and use it to somehow say, I did it wrong. It's me, I'm bad, I've failed, I'm no good. It's my fault. Sense of guilt, again, the sense of shame, the sense of blame, the sense of self-attacking. And that the thing that happened that was difficult or less than perfect, somehow the confirmation, the evidence and the confirmation that there's something wrong with me. And you know, there isn't. The way life is not your fault. How your life has been is not your fault. And you know that. I know you know that. And we don't always really know that. It's not your fault. Really? It's not your fault. If we can start to release the need to locate ourselves as responsible for life, and we start to free ourselves, responsible for the way life is, and we start to free ourselves from the burden of somehow feeling that we are to blame for the fact that life has within it suffering, cruelty, blindness, and pain. Life also, of course, has beauty, joy, nobility, magic. And sometimes we can feel the sense of that too. It's beautiful, it's powerful to do so. But that sense of I'm doing it, I'm somehow making my life happen or making life happen, what that gives us is at a very deep level, and it's a very strong attachment, it gives us a sense that we're in control. And that sense of control is one of the very deep ways in which we defend against we defend against letting in the vulnerability, letting in the fact that we are subject to life, not in our control, not as we choose it. Despite that we can influence it, and we can in many ways, it's so. Because we're not doing it, we're not making it happen. We're not in charge of this. The breath breathes. Digestion, you put food in your mouth, body digestion. Life happens, and it's unstoppable. It's unstoppable. And even the thoughts in our minds, I mean, I've got to stop that thinking. You know, here are my 4 days of meditation and still my mind is thinking. You know, if you want your mind to stop, there's a really simple operation. Don't think that's what you're here for. I don't recommend it. You know, it'd be like with the breath. You think if you're watching your breath, the breath is going to stop? Doesn't sound like a good idea, does it? Keep watching my breath, it should stop? No, and we're dead. Thoughts? I remember the retreat on which this occurred to me. It was a very important moment, just very simple. Thoughts? Oh, they're going to keep happening. Kind of obvious really, isn't it? They're going to keep happening. Ones I like, ones I don't. Made a big difference for me. Maybe not for you, but maybe you already got that. But like grass grows on the land, thoughts grow in the mind. Happens. The thoughts are not what we are, any more than the grass is the earth. Although it is from the earth and of the earth and not apart from it. Likewise thoughts. You know, it's a bit like if you go on a journey in a boat. You could imagine someone going onto the sea in a small boat, and the wind and the sail and the waves and the currents, all the things you must deal with. You have the steering wheel on the boat for going this way, that way. After a while you notice that sometimes it goes this way and sometimes it goes that way, and even though you're steering this way, sometimes it's going that way. Anyone have that experience in life? Sometimes you think, stop, stop, and it gets faster. We think, go faster, it slows down. And so this man is doing this on the boat, and then after a while he's wondering, so he goes downstairs and he says, oh, steering wheel, it wasn't connected to the steering rudder. No connection. He recognizes. Of course, can still make some difference, but to let yourself encounter the fullness of the impact, the power and the potency for transformation of life is to, or it asks us to let ourselves feel this vulnerability, this out of controlness, to sense what that's like, to feel how hard it is, to be compassionate for ourselves about how hard it is to allow this. And yet, so far as we can, begin to allow it to touch you more and more deeply. We have to let go of the illusion of control, the hope of security, and that includes letting go of the ideas we have that give us this, and religious consolation such as there is life after death, going to heaven or another rebirth. We don't know. We don't know. And it's just a nice way of saying, I can be comfortable, I know. It's not true. And it easily leads to complacency, to thinking, oh, I'll wait, see what happens. And in fact, the scientific position that tends to say, you know, rational materialist scientific viewpoint that says, no, after death, nothing. that's also consolation. It's also a false certainty. We don't know. We don't know. If we stay with the truth of that don't know, then we can start to feel, we can start to sense the vibration where that takes us. That there's a way in which that we believe in death, and we're so concerned only so far as we're identified with this body and mind and this idea of self that's connected to this body and this mind, it seems. This changing body, this changing mind, this changing self. So long as we're identified with this, we are in fear of death. Because this is and must be subject to that. And yet to feel the vibration of the uncertainty, of the uncontrollableness of life, is to also open ourselves out to being, to open ourselves up, open ourselves out to being touched. Just as some of you have reported that as you let yourself feel some of the difficult experiences, you realize you're more open to that which is beautiful, that which is touching, that which is lovely. But as we let ourselves feel the discomfort of the heart or the body, the beauty of the trees or the nobility of someone taking one quiet step touches us. And it's sweet and it's beautiful. So too in this way, as we open more deeply to that which is most scary, we also open to that which is most profound and most beautiful. Although that which is born must die, this life is not defined by that or contained within that. It contains it. Birth and death are part of life and fall within it. And yet life is vast, beyond conceiving, and yet can be known, can be realized, can be discovered. To recognize, to encounter, to be touched by life and the life that shows its immense dimensionality that is beyond death, that is not limited to those things which are born and which die, but nor is apart from them, not as distant from them or separate in any way or removed at all from life that is born and dies, and yet is not constrained or confined by that. This we are invited to discover. It is for this we are asked to take up wholeheartedly the challenge. To open to this life unconditionally. I'd like to finish with a quote from Ajahn Sucitto, who's a monk, a British man who's the abbot of a monastery in England, and I count myself very fortunate to be have him both as a teacher and a friend. And he, in a talk once said this. He said, "There is no real learning on the intellectual level. There is only a kind of learning that we do when we have the humility to recognize that really the learning part is when we go to the edge of where we know and where we control. And the nobility of our life, the nobility of our purpose, the aspiration of our life says, keep going, past the area where you can't control it anymore, and trust. For me, this is the heart of devotion, of faith, of surrender. Not a surrender of responsibility, but a profound recognition of what the responsibility of this being is, to live in accordance with truth, to honor truth, and to trust the truth of our life as it is. What lies beyond me and control and the sense of self is the joy of the deathless, the joy of the boundless, the mysterious vastness of life." us here together and in our lives. Allow ourselves to be touched. Make peace with vulnerability and open to the mysterious vastness of life for our own well-being, for the welfare of all beings.
Mm-hmm.